All right, we're going to come to order. We're actually going to, until we get a quorum, we're actually going to start with 1320, because the other one should go very quickly once we get a quorum here. So this is what we're going to, how we're going to do this. Okay. Yeah, so we're going to have 10 minutes for each of the, 10 minutes for the proponents, 10 minutes for the opponents, and then we're going to have some time for questions. And we're going to vote on the bill, you know, by like 20 after. Okay. And then Representative Swales will have a little additional time to present the bill. So I will move 1320 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As many of you know, in my other life, I'm a high school English teacher, and in December, I had an experience that is one that teachers I've heard about, and yet I had experienced it only briefly many years ago. One of my seniors stood up and then fell and had a grand mal seizure in my classroom. And I was so impressed by the students in my class who had the presence of mind to get up. They cleared furniture out of the way. They exited. They went into the hall. They sat on the floor. Others went and got the principal and the nurse and the football coach and a couple of other people who could help lift this young man into a wheelchair. But as a classroom teacher who really is more concerned about gerunds and participles, this was quite the experience for me. And I realized the stigma and the problems that this particular disease creates for so many individuals. So it is with a tremendous amount of humility and also an honor to sit here and to advocate for this bill. I have a tremendously gifted and articulate advocate sitting next to me, Sarah Goodnow, and she is also my constituent, along with her dad, Kevin Goodnow. And we've been working on this bill for a couple of years now, and I am so impressed with her passion and her desire to do something meaningful for people who suffer with this disease. So if I can introduce them.
Sure, please. Welcome to the committee, and please just identify yourself for us.
You want to say your name?
Okay. I'm Sarah Goodnow.
And I'm Kevin Goodnow, and I actually am the president of the board of the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, and I'm a father of a 12-year-old with epilepsy. And this is as much as Sarah agreed to do as introduce herself.
So okay.
I wanted to know that. If you force her to do anything else, I'm going to pay for it at home later on. So. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're here today to talk about the House File 1320, which empowers people with epilepsy to make their own decisions with regard to the medicines that they take. Simply what the bill does is that if you're a person who's been taking anti-seizure medicines for 60 days or more, so you've already been taking the medicine for 60 days or more, that the pharmacist, if they're going to switch the medication from the medication you're taking, either from a brand to a generic or from one manufactured generic to another, that they have to get your permission as a patient to do that. That's all the bill does, and then notify the doctor within 10 days. So get your permission as a patient that they're going to switch the medicine, and then notify the doctor within 10 days. There's no allowance here. There's nothing in the bill that says the patient needs to demand a different drug or gets the right to do that or override any of the doctor's decision. It's about getting the permission of the patient before the drug is switched. So why should we do this for people with epilepsy, and what is epilepsy? Epilepsy is a label that people put on various seizure disorders that are out there. Seizures can take many different forms, but the most popular or most common one that people associate with epilepsy is a grand mal seizure, where you have the full convulsives on the floor and you lose complete control of yourself and the activities that you do. When you have epilepsy and when you have seizures, one of the key goals in dealing with epilepsy is you want to get seizure control as quickly as possible, because the more seizures you have, the more likely it is you're going to have more. The more seizures you have, the harder it is to control the seizures when you have them. Once you have seizure control, the one thing you don't want to do is lose the control. Because once you lose seizure control and you have a breakthrough seizure, 25% of those people never gain seizure control again. It's not like having high blood pressure medicine where your blood pressure goes up and it can come back down again. You may never get control of the seizures again. 25% of those that have breakthrough seizures. Now, so it's very important to keep that control. Folks out there, and you'll be hearing from, and there's letters in your packets that were distributed from the American Academy of Neurology, doctors who deal with people with epilepsy, and also from 8 Mayo doctors who deal, are epileptologists or neurologists that also deal with people on a daily basis. We also will have a testifier coming from that deals with people with epilepsy. They feel there's a concern. They feel that when there's a switch from one medication to another, that it can, in some people, cause breakthrough seizures. You're going to hear from a number of other people that say there's no problem, don't worry about it, trust the FDA. We've done our internal data runs. It doesn't show anything. But the people that work with people with epilepsy think there's a problem. If there's a problem, then I think we need to address it. This is just one simple way of doing it. It has nothing to do with mandating coverage. It doesn't mean that that the health insurance plans have to pay for it. It just says the patient has control of the decision on if it should be switched or not. They have to make the decision if they want to pay the extra money for the brand drug or the other generic, but that's a decision for the patient. We're putting the patient in control. What this bill does not impact, and there's been a lot of red herrings and straw man arguments out there, it does not impact, has nothing to do with dispense as written. It has nothing to do with dispense as written. If people are saying that, they haven't read the bill and they don't understand it. This deals with medicines that have been going on and been taken by a person for 60 days or more. Dispense as written is a law that talks about at the initial time when you get the prescription, that's when the doctor can say dispense as written and you have to take the drug that the doctor, or disperse the drug that the doctor wrote about. That's not what we're here about. This is about after they're on a course of treatment, be it generic or brand, that the medication, if there's a switch, you have to get the permission of the patient. It has nothing to do with dispense as written. It has nothing to do with that initial dispensation of the pharmaceutical. The other thing that I need to address, because nobody mentioned it publicly, but I'm hearing that members have been talked about, the fact that one of the reasons maybe why the Epilepsy Foundation is interested in this is because we get so much money from the pharmaceutical companies. Less than 5% of our budget comes from pharmaceutical companies. Less than 5%. Now, I need to say from PBMs, PBAs, generics, we don't get anything. I'm not sure who that's an indictment of. Everybody's profiting. Everybody makes money from people with epilepsy. We don't want to get in the middle of an argument about market share. I don't really care who's profiting under this as long as what we're doing benefits the people that have epilepsy out here in Minnesota. And I'm a little bit disturbed by some of the arguments that are being used against it and the straw man arguments that are being used against it that I think are very disingenuous. I didn't mean to get this emotional. It's one of those things that I've appeared in front of this committee in a number of different roles. This is the first time I've appeared in front of this committee as a father. And so if we can keep people from suffering the consequences of a breakthrough seizure, which can cause death, which can cause injury, which can create problems with development of younger people, I think we should be doing it. And we should put the patient in control. So I'd appreciate your support for this legislation.
And we're waiting on questions until the testimony is done.
I have to go to different meetings. I just wanted to give a plug for the bill. So it's
all right,
bill.
Thank you. Thanks. All right. Welcome to the committee. Oh, first of all, we have a quorum, so we'll start. And now I'll move that 1320 be recommended pass and re-referred to finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, representatives. My name is Lori Ullman. This is a simple issue of having control of one's health care. I've been diagnosed with epilepsy for 30-plus years. Half of those years spent going from one medication to another trying to find control, and the other half was spent medically controlled and seizure-free, to include a two-year period where I was both medication and seizure-free. And gave birth to a beautiful, beautiful baby boy. 3 months after that, my seizures came back, and I spent several years trying to get seizure-free again. In 1994, I'd been seizure-free for almost 5 years and started having cluster seizures. It was thought that my meds just simply quit working and was put on Neurontin, and with some control, but not total control, and it took until 1999 for me to get complete control of my seizures.
6 months after my cluster seizure started and I was put on this new medication, my doctor told me that my breakthrough seizure control was due to the switching of generic to generic. I am now on a generic form of Zonegran and have been seizure-free for almost 8 years. As an epileptic, I don't have control when I have a seizure. I've been at the Metrodome's women's bathroom convulsing on the floor while people stepped over me. I have taken out the side view mirror of my car with my head during a convulsion. I've been abandoned by my date with my face in the plate of my spaghetti having a tonic-clonic. I have awakened to my young son kneeling beside my head, stroking my hair, saying, "It's going to be okay, Mommy." This I do not have control over. What I should have control over is what I'm putting in my body and know what it is. You may hear testimony today about an only 5% increase or decrease. When my doctor decides to up my medication, I know I'm upping my medication. I can choose to start that on a Thursday and have the weekend to see whether or not the side effects are going to take place and knock my world out. When the pharmacist decides to change from one brand of generic to another brand of generic, and there's a 5% difference, I deal with vertigo. I deal with dizzying spells. I deal with nausea. I deal with anxiety. When I arrive at the pharmacy and look at my medication and the maker underneath my medication is no longer the same, and I ask the pharmacist why, we no longer carry that maker. I now have the next 3 to 5 days to find that maker at another pharmacy, hoping that my current supply that I have, that 3 to 5 day supply, will be there by the time I find my maker. Because my insurance company only allows me to buy my medication every 30, 60, or 90 days. It is my right to be in charge of my health care. It is my right to be in charge of what I put into my body. And it is my right to be notified when my medication is changed, which all takes all of a 20-second phone call, a 20-second email, or a 20-second text message. I have the right not to die from choking on my spit or my puke and leave my husband and my son to deal with the chaos. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Ilo Lepic. I'm a professor of neurology and a professor of pharmacy, so I have a dual appointment at the University of Minnesota.
And we just have like 3 or 4 minutes, so
sure.
Thanks.
I have been in practice in this community since 1976, focusing on treating epilepsy. I've done a lot of research with epilepsy drugs, and I want to make two statements. First, this 5% is a misnomer. That's an average, and I've seen the FDA studies. And what they do is they will take volunteers and it will give them one dose of a drug and or the generic, and then they'll average it together. And in we know every individual is different, and I have patients that are different. So the 5% is an average. And if you look at the FDA studies, you will see that individual patients in those studies, somebody might be 15% off, another maybe 15% above, but the average is zero. So this 5% is a misnomer. I just want to tell you one patient experience of many, but this is probably the most dramatic. This is a woman that I've treated for 10 years. She lives in Afton, and we finally got her controlled with a new brand medicine. In the summer of 2008, the medicine became generic. She was switched to generic. She did not notify me. She did not think this would be a problem. She was driving. She was working. She got out of her house and going to her car to get onto I-94, and just as she left her house, she had a grand mal seizure on her steps. The neighbors called. She was taken to a hospital. They checked her blood level. Her blood level was 30% less than what it had been during clinic visits. We were notified immediately. We put her back on brand, and her blood level came back to the levels that she had experienced. And she now has had seizure control again for the last year and a half. So I think the point here is that people with epilepsy, I'm not talking about other drugs for hypertension, but people with epilepsy are brittle. Everybody understands a brittle diabetic who may suddenly get a little bit too much insulin and go into insulin shock. But what I don't think the general public understands, that many patients with epilepsy are very brittle, and that even a 5 or 10% difference, and it's usually sometimes even more, can cause some serious problems. Physician knows who the brittle patients are. I know who my brittle patients are. There are many of my patients who are going to be switched from generic to generic or brand to brand. It won't make a difference. But I do have about 20 or 30% of my patients who are very brittle. And for these people, without me knowing that there will be a change in from one brand of generic or one manufacturer to another, or from brand to generic, can cause a problem. And so I personally think the safety of my patients relies on my being able to tell the pharmacist, okay, to switch this person from generic to generic or brand to generic or vice versa, or this is a brittle patient. And in fact, in my clinic notes, I specify this is a brittle patient, so that if any pharmacist would call, my staff could look in my notes and say, yes, this is a brittle patient, please do not switch, or it's okay. So I want to emphasize that this bill is not about brand versus generic. It's about the physician and doctor and the patient being in control of what is going on in terms of what medication they're being given. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're going to just take all the testimony, and then everybody will be around for questions later. So the next testifier, Dr. Strawn, Mr. Strawn. And if Mr. Lott and Mr. Root want to be ready to go, too. And so we'll go about 12 minutes here. So if you, and there's seven testifiers in opposition, I think, so please keep that in mind. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. If we may start in a slightly different
order. Yeah, you can go whatever order you want, yes.
Thank you.
And just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Bruce Lott, and I'm the Director of State Government Relations for Mylan. Mylan is one of the world's leading generic pharmaceutical manufacturers, and we're the largest U.S.-based manufacturer of generic drugs. Since we're very short time here, I'll be extremely quick. We respectfully oppose the legislation. We believe this legislation will increase the cost of health care for the state, particularly with regard to Medicaid, state public employees, and that will also increase the cost of health care for consumers. More than 70% of prescriptions filled in Minnesota's Medicaid program for the treatment of epilepsy are filled with generics currently. Even a 1% reduction in generic utilization within your Medicaid program will cost the state roughly $1 million a year just for antiepileptics. We urge the committee to consider the costs of Medicaid and health care before making a decision on this issue. I'd also like to point out that Minnesota law currently requires that the name of the manufacturer be printed on the label of the bottle that when you the patient receives it from the pharmacy. So in order for those patients who do have particular issues with regard to the physicians are concerned about, all they have to do is look at the bottle from one prescription and the bottle from the other prescription and know if there has been a change or not. So they already have access to the information that this bill proposes to change, but they have that access to information without the extra burdens involved. I'd like to turn it over to Art Strawn, who is a professor emeritus from the University of Tennessee. He's an expert in pharmacokinetics and has more than 35 years experience testing generic drugs under contract for the Food and Drug Administration.
Okay, and I'm Dr. Strawn. I just would like to point out, I want to be here for informational purposes only. I really don't have a dog in this race. So I want to clarify what the Food and Drug Administration's regulations are in terms of the approval process of these generic drugs and what those mean in terms of substitution, what is allowed as far as substitution. First of all, there's two things that need to be understood. One is that in order to do a substitution, it has to be a pharmaceutically equivalent drug. That means that you have to do a tablet drug for a tablet drug. It has to be exactly the same active ingredient, exactly the same active ingredient chemical, and it has to be in the same amount. Now, when a drug is manufactured, it also has all kinds of quality control aspects to it that need to be checked off and approved every time a new batch is made. And these are identical not only for the brand drug, they are the same as they are for the generic. The brand and the generic have the same approval processes. Now, therefore, you have pharmaceutically equivalents that can be substituted. Next, in terms of approval, the generic has to be known to be bioequivalent. And briefly, it says if your generic is bioequivalent, that means it will achieve the same drug levels from absorption of that drug as the brand product. These studies are done in cadres of people. They're done in human trials, and the expectation is that there will be no significant difference between the blood profiles that you obtain from the generic and the blood profiles that you obtain from the brand. Now, there's criticism that says, well, these studies are done in normal subjects. Well, the fact of the matter is that in studies that are done in patients that are trying to do the generic approval process, you find that they're far less sensitive. In other words, patients are far less sensitive to obtain the parameters that you want than a actual normal subject. Finally, I'd like to, because we have a bunch of witnesses, finally, I'd like to point out to you that the Food and Drug Administration is acutely aware of issues related especially to epileptic drugs. And I would advise all the patients and other physicians who are here to file these, what they call product defect reports, with the Food and Drug Administration so that they can thoroughly investigate this. In addition, the National Institutes of Health and the FDA this year have combined to make a very, very large contribution to conduct a multi-center clinical trial to evaluate the exact issues that you are talking about with this bill. In other words, they are going to do in epileptic patients a large cadre of those patients who are stable or unstable at centers around the country and find out if, in fact, switching these patients from brand to generic, brand to brand, a different lot of the same brand, or generic to generic, has any adverse effect in terms of the treatment of these patients. And I'll be glad to answer other questions later.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Maloney. I'm Vice President of Business Development at Paddock Laboratories. It's a generic pharmaceutical manufacturer and distributor based in New Hope, Minnesota. We employ somewhere north of 400 employees. We're not the biggest generic company by far, but we're a player in that business. And I want to tell you a little story. I was in this Capitol complex about 13 years ago to testify about the dangers of generic drug substitution for warfarin sodium, also known as Coumadin. And fortunately, the Board of Pharmacy agreed with my opinion that generics were substitutable. And now, 13 years later, there's never been a whisper of a problem with the substitution of these drugs. And I think the reason why we can know that is that the agency that approves these drugs, the brand drug, the FDA, is also the same agency that approves the generic drug. And they use good science and the same science in both cases. And so I urge you to oppose this bill because we can't second-guess the science the FDA uses because they're the most respected agency in the world with some of the preeminent scientists in the world.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Vern Rowan. I'm Vice President of State Government Affairs for Express Scripts. We're a pharmacy benefit manager. We manage the prescription drug benefit for about 50 million Americans across the country. We're hired by health plans, large employers, state governments. The U.S. Department of Defense is one of our largest clients. One of the most important things we do for our clients is provide them with expert recommendations on how they should structure their drug benefit, what they should cover under their drug benefit, how they should cover things under their drug benefit. Let me start by saying that the stories that were told at the beginning of this are clearly very real stories, very passionate stories, and there's a problem. These are very heart-wrenching stories. If this was something that affected one of my children, I would be just as concerned, and I'd want to look for any explanation I could find to explain what happened to my child and is there a way for me to deal with that and control that. Having said that, our viewpoint is that there are anecdotes that might suggest there's a causal relationship here, but there does not seem to be scientific evidence yet that suggests that there is a relationship between switching from branded generic or generic to generic and the causation of seizures in epileptics. There are anecdotes, not evidence. I can say that based on a review that we've done of a very robust database that we have, about 50 million Americans, about 34,000 epileptics that met our criteria, and we followed about 3,000 cases. We were able to look at both their medical data and their prescription drug use. We were able to look at their emergency room intake, use of ambulances, other services. We could not find a relationship here that would justify going against the FDA's recommendation, which would say that these drugs are not substitutable or that there was a concern in substituting them. And I'll be honest, we view ourselves as impartial in this. We undertook this review because if there was a medical problem, we wanted to make sure that we weren't making recommendations that were going to compromise patient care. On the other hand, if there was no evidence of a problem, we didn't want to do something or make a recommendation that would reduce the opportunity for our clients to save valuable health care resources by continuing to promote the use of generics. So that was our point in undertaking that. We continue to advise our clients that these drugs are substitutable. There's not an issue in terms of substituting them. Let me move on to a point that was addressed, and it was stated that this has nothing to do with dispense as written. You're right. This bill doesn't say anything about dispense as written. But the point in discussion about dispenses written is this. Physicians have control over what is prescribed and what is dispensed to their patients. The truth of the matter is pharmacists don't get to decide what is dispensed to a patient. If a physician has a concern about a patient and has a concern that if there's a generic substitution or a change from one generic manufactured generic to another manufacturer's generic, state law provides them the opportunity to write dispense as written on that script, and they can even go so far as to say, this is the name of the manufacturer of the generic that I want dispensed to this patient. The pharmacist has to follow the physician's wishes. It's against the law if they don't. They're held accountable if they don't. My point in saying that is these are very real concerns that were brought to you by the proponents of this legislation. My point is there's another way to deal with this that doesn't involve this legislation. It was also characterized that there's really no cost to this legislation. It's just notification. Well, it's not quite that simple. I mean, it's easy to say we all agree everyone should have informed consent in what they do. We don't disagree with that. The problem with this bill as it's crafted is it creates an explicit obligation on pharmacists to notify patients, but also that would get informed consent from patients, but then also notify physicians. It's not clear in the bill what constitutes notification. It's not clear in the bill how a pharmacist can prove that they notified the physician appropriately. And it's not clear what the consequences are if the pharmacist didn't do it. Now, there was discussion, I've heard discussion earlier, that it's not an issue, there's not liability. Well, if we're going to the trouble of enacting a statute, telling someone to do something, and we're saying there's no liability and there are no consequences, I question why we're going to the trouble of enacting the statute. I think there is liability, there are consequences to this.
And we have about a minute to go, so
I understand.
We have two other testifiers.
Let me make one more point, and then I'll conclude. There was a discussion about the variances of clinical effectiveness of different generics. There is a variance that the FDA looks at, and if it's within a certain variance, it's acceptable for substitution. They evaluate brand name drugs the same way. And in fact, there can be the same level of variance in clinical effectiveness from one lot of a brand name drug to a different lot of the same brand name drug. So if there is a relationship here in terms of substitution, in terms of clinical effectiveness and variances in that and causing seizures, the same thing should be happening to people who are on the same brand name drug, because the same variants can exist and sometimes does. I would ask you to oppose this bill. It does cost money, and it doesn't address the issue that these, they're clear there are good intentions behind this. I think there are other ways to address the issue short of this legislation.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and just a few, we don't have much time, so let's not duplicate testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll be brief. My name is Tim Gallagher. I'm a pharmacist. I'm the director of pharmacy for A-Strip Drug. We're a regional chain based out of Austin. I also happen to be the parent of a 23-year-old son who has had epilepsy for a little over 10 years now. So rather than just repeat what all my colleagues said, I'll talk more from a personal perspective. And we actually took my son to Mayo Clinic, and ironically, one of the physicians that treated my son had signed the letter. They actually were not able to control his seizures with two brand-name prescription drugs, and we subsequently went to MNCEP, where they did add a third prescription drug, and now he takes three medications for his seizures. He has a refractory form of epilepsy, but we now have had his seizures under control for the first time in 10 years for about the last year and a half. Subsequent to his control, all three of those drugs became available as a generic. He now is using three generic medications that he was switched to from brand to generic with no problems whatsoever. And I can tell you that also he has been switched from one brand of generic to another with no problems. And again, you know, the FDA doesn't see it as a problem. I don't see it as a problem in most cases. And again, in all due respect to Mr. Goodnow, I do think, even though, and I have read the bill, it doesn't specifically mention DAW. I do think it's about DAW, because in the cases of brittle patients, like Dr. Lepic said, if there's issues where patients should not be switched, then the physician can control that, and the pharmacies and pharmacists are obligated to honor that. So finally, when looking at costs, I can tell you that this absolutely will increase costs. It will increase health care costs to all of us, not the least of which is the state of Minnesota. There will be more brand name prescriptions filled. And if we set a precedent and change the law for anti-epileptic medications, the next will be prescriptions for patients with diabetics and asthma, and on and on and on. From a personal perspective on the cost, when my son was on two drugs and we have a high deductible health care plan, I was paying $2,000 a month for two prescription drugs. Now he's on three generics and it cost me $200 a month. So I think it's an issue that's steeped in emotion, but frankly, I think we need to take the emotion out of it, and we ought to look at the science, and there's no good evidence this is a problem. The proponents usually use anecdotal evidence, reports from patients, and I think, frankly, we need to look at the science. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, welcome, and members of the committee, I'm Bruce Thompson. I'm Director of Pharmacy Services at Hennepin County Medical Center and currently acting as President of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. You have the position paper in front of you from the association, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the emotions, and I've been fortunate not to have seizure activity within our direct family, but treated many patients over the years I've been in the profession. It is an issue, honestly, about having seizure control, but sometimes the decision to switch from one brand to another or generic to another generic isn't in the pharmacist's hands. Currently, we have 27 drug manufacturers that are out of very important medications that we have to switch every other day, because otherwise there's no medicine at all. It's a nightmare within the hospital arena. It's the same within the epileptic or the seizure control activity medications. Sometimes you just simply can't get that brand. But as a pharmacist, I'm not aware of any pharmacy that wouldn't notify the patient that we needed to switch your brand or we did switch your brand. Sometimes it's quality issues and sometimes it's cost issues or just availability. The scientific evidence is important, and I do think that other very restricted areas such as renal transplant or heart transplant patients, they also have struggled with this, but they've not found any significant difference or therapeutic difference between brand and generic or generic to generic. The FDA's job is to verify that the medications are safe, and every lot that a brand name or a generic manufacturer makes can have that variability of plus or minus a certain percentage. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Bunn, did you have questions? We'll open it to questions,
okay. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Ms. Goodenough, if you could come up. Please. Thank you. One clarification on the dispenses written discussion, and others can step up to answer if you're not the appropriate person or others want to chime in. Where does this break down for you in terms of if there's the start of the 60 days, dispenses written was indicated, what happens where this would break down and were there many ways it could break down? And that's right. My first question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, thanks for the question. First of all, what I see as a distinction between DAW and the requirement of this bill mm-hmm. is that this bill allows you to go to the generic medication right away. It doesn't force the doctor to prescribe and say, gee, I want a generic. Now I have to find out what manufacturer's generic is being distributed by your pharmacy. What they would typically do, I'm assuming, out of the ease of it, is just say, I'm going to do the brand name drug and do dispenses written. So I actually think that this bill allows for, rather than going to the suggestion of the other folks saying go to DAW right away on the brand, that allows you to get into a course of treatment with the generic, mm-hmm. and then after 60 days you need that notification. What breaks down in DAW otherwise, and we found this out at a meeting we had with the pharmacists a few years back when we were trying to address their concerns when the original bill draft came out, was that not all the time when the prescription, when there is even DAW at the beginning, a year later when the prescription comes up for renewal, the DAW portion isn't always communicated between the doctor, and there's a breakdown in the communication between the doctor's office and the pharmacy at that point, and sometimes that falls off as well. Mm-hmm. But I actually will go back to, once there's a course of treatment with anti-seizure medicine, 60 days or more, that this is when this kicks in. And yesterday, actually we had this hearing in the Senate yesterday as well, and somebody made the concern that there was going to cost DHS a lot of money. Well, when I was commissioner, I was reminded of this by Cody Weiberg, that we implemented a law that under people on MA have to try generics first. And then if generics fail, then they can go and petition to be put on branded. Mm-hmm. Well, this is consistent with that because if it's generics first, and they're on a course of treatment for 60 days or more on that generic, all we're doing is, again, advising the patient that the change has taken place. So, I mean, I don't believe there's a fiscal note they're talking about, but that's, again, why it's going to Finance Committee as well. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bunn?
I'm sorry, could I make one comment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, go ahead. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay.
Did
you
want to? From a personal standpoint, as far as DAW, if my doctor writes DAW for the generic and the maker that I have for my Zonogram, and I go into my pharmacist, or my pharmacist calls me all of a sudden and says, we don't carry that brand anymore, I have a 3-day supply to go and find that maker. Mm-hmm. Or they have to ship it in. So somewhere in there, I have a 3 to 5 day supply while they go find that maker. That's what DAW does to me.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bunn.
Well, to follow up, in terms of that, from my understanding of how the bill would work, I'm not sure what the length of time for notification, but it also might still be a relatively short period of time for a pharmacist to notify you that they no longer have that drug or whatever. But to follow up on the dispenses written, why couldn't the rules around dispenses written be changed, such that if you start out with a name brand, but generics become available on the market, but there's been a long-standing dispenses written for a certain brand, that the pharmacist has to communicate with that, with the physician, and to see if they're willing to change to the new generic or the particular generic that that pharmacy. I know there's generic specific to specific pharmacy chains as well, or have some various stages there in terms of follow-up that are pursued so that they reaffirm that the original order is still the one that should be followed ongoing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, we haven't explored that element of mm-hmm. how to pursue this requirement. I do think that I know Dr. Lepik is just chomping at the bit to get up here and talk again about the science behind stuff. There's definitely a difference of opinion with regard to if generics are exactly equivalent to the mm-hmm. brand or if they're exactly equivalent to another generic, especially when dealing with seizure disorders. Mm-hmm. The DAW is very prescriptive. I think this actually is relatively flexible when it comes to the pharmacist side in dealing with the patient. And, you know, quite frankly, I had somebody mention to me, why would we even need this law? Isn't this what should be happening anyway when there's a change in medication for an individual? And, you know, I had a hard time answering that question.
Mm-hmm. Resident Button,
Well, just to follow up on that, and maybe the first doctor would comment on this too, but given that there seems to be this concern about the brittle patients versus the non-brittle patients, then maybe that's not the issue for a lot of people. But if that's really something that physicians can know about their patients when they work a long time with their epileptic patients, it seems like there's a much smaller number of people than you could pursue the dispenses written process with, whereas everyone else, the non-brittle group, we wouldn't incur the cost and paperwork and all that with the pharmacist that would be involved on the other side.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, let me address it from a layperson's perspective. I think Dr. Lepik would have a different maybe a variation of this perspective. One thing we found out when we started dealing with neurologists and epileptologists is that seizure control is part science and part art. That we always like to rely on medicine to think that doctors have all the answers, and it was really an eye-opening experience to find out they don't. But there is kind of a trial and error period here. So sometimes I would say there are probably some patients that really are clearly brittle, and some that you really don't know if there's going to be an interaction, there's going to be a problem or not. The one thing that we want to make sure we encourage as a foundation, the Epilepsy Foundation, is our folks want to have access to generics because in a lot of cases that's the only medication they can afford. And so the intent of this bill is not to move away from generics or to keep people away from generics. It's just to make sure that they know when a switch is taking place. With that, I'll defer to Dr. Lepik.
We have three other questioners. I think what we're going to do is you can come to the and answer that question. I think we're going to lay this bill over and come back tonight about 6:30. I think licensing starts at 6:30 and deal with the rest of the questions that everybody has coming up here because we got to move on to other stuff, unless people want to drop their questions. But, Doctor.
I'll be very brief. I'm both a scientist. I've written over 200 papers dealing with epilepsy and anti-epileptic drugs. I'm a professor of pharmacy in the College of Pharmacy. I've worked with bioavailability and generic equivalents. And I want to point out one very important situation. There's science, which is based on many patients, is based on statistics. And I deal with that in my clinical research. But then there are individual patients, and we know that individual patients are different. And when you look at the science from the FDA, which I've looked at, I mentioned earlier, in that 5% average, there are people who are way beyond either below or above that 5%. So I think the scientists, which I agree with, are really not experiencing, and they keep saying, well, anecdotes don't seem to matter, but I deal with individual patients. And when I see somebody, many of my patients, at MNCEP, by the way, we've kept track of people who fail generics or fail switch to switch. And I didn't want to bring that list with me today, but I just want to make sure the committee understands the difference between science, which some people seem to think is the be-end-end-all, and taking that science, which I believe in, but trying to apply it to individual patients. And so there are individual patients. The science may say this will work, but there are probably 5 or 10 or 15% of people for whom the science doesn't apply. Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, what Representative Bunn was talking about, I had just like a clarification because a couple of testifiers spoke to it, but is it true that it is in statute that if a physician wrote, dispense as written, and you're very concerned as a patient, if they wrote that, would it make that illegal for a pharmacist to substitute then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, it would be a violation of the Pharmacy Act, and so the pharmacist would be subject to discipline by the Board of Pharmacy, as would be the case of any other violation if this law passed as well.
And Mr. Gallagher, did you want to say something to that? Is that?
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question. I think it may be for Dr. Strawn, if he was here, the person from Tennessee. I don't know if he's still in the room. And I was just curious. I thought I heard you say that the FDA was going to be looking at this particular issue.
Yes, there is a Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, New York, has they're currently finalizing all of the clinical protocols for their multi-center clinical trial. When they do finish that, I'm sure that the public will be notified as to the progress that they will be making. This was part of a directive that was given a year or so ago, and as you understand, it does take a while for things to roll through the processes, and they were supposed to have this study completed by the end of this year. Now, since they haven't enrolled their first patient yet, I doubt that it would, but they were going to go for I don't know how many months they were going to go before switching, but it is a well-designed multi-center trial that will be conducted.
Just curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What triggered that directive? Has the FDA been receiving a number of complaints or?
Mr. Strawn.
Okay. I think I had mentioned that for the last 30 years, 35 years, we've been doing studies at the University of Tennessee as a backup for the FDA's decision-making process. And in many cases, the studies that they'd ask us to do, this is probably 10, 15 years ago, when for example, Valium went off of patent, and it was the largest drug maker for Roche at that time, and people were complaining left and right about how the Valium that's in the generic is not even the same drug. It's a different drug. It's not, and they said that they changed their formulation to make it pH dependent. So we did some very sophisticated studies.
I think the question
is
there a concern that prompted the study, or is it just they wanted to follow up? And if you have some information,
they really just want to follow up on the concerns that they have received.
Okay. Thank you. And when is that study going to be done? Do we know for sure?
Well, it was supposed to be completed, but if they haven't even enrolled their first patient.
Okay.
If I may, that.
And just say your name for the record, if you could.
My name is Bruce Lott. I'm with Mylan. The language was put into federal law at the request of the Epilepsy Foundation.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be real quick here. First of all, I wanted if the gentleman who was just there could stay for just a second, Dr. Strawn. Yeah, I just wanted to ask you real quick. I understand you're from Tennessee, and I'm just wondering, are you here today being sponsored by somebody, or are you here on your own, or how did you get here from
Tennessee? I think I misspoke when I said I don't have a dog in the race. Mm-hmm. I am being sponsored by the Generic Pharmaceutical Association out of Washington, D.C., and so they are paying my expenses, yes.
Okay, thank you for that.
I am very sorry that I didn't let that out. But
okay.
I feel like I'm here just for informational purposes.
Okay. Well, just for the committee members, disclosure is very important.
I agree. I do not want to pull the wool over anybody's eyes.
Thank you. And secondly, I just had a couple quick questions about the bill itself, maybe for Representative Swales or maybe for Mr. Goodnow. And I just wondered a little bit about the operational, how this is going to work in operation.
Well, okay, I think we're gonna move on then to the next bill, and then we'll come back tonight to finish this up, because we do have to get the rest of this testimony in. Okay, so I'm going to lay this bill over. Representative, because I think there's probably more questions that people have. Representative Swales, then we'll move. I'll move House File 3116, that be recommended to pass, and that's the construction moratorium bill. Recommend it pass and be re-referred to the floor. General Register? General Register. And so. Oh, yeah. Yes. Judy.
Pass these up.
But you're right. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to mess with you a little bit, I'd like to propose a 146 hospital bed yes. hospital in yes. Woodbury.
Okay.
You don't like that idea.
So, no, we'll just proceed with the bill. And it seems like a fairly simple bill.
It is. If the people from Prairie St. John's could come and join me. Mr. Chair, really, it's a cleanup bill from last year. As you know, the bill said that a hospital would be built in western Hennepin County, but it is 4,000 feet short of western Hennepin County, and actually the property where the hospital is going to be built is in eastern Hennepin County. And we understand that we have to be very precise in the statute that was passed, and so we're simply asking that this 4,000-foot extension into western Hennepin County be acknowledged and put in and replace the language in the previous bill.
Do members have any questions about the bill?
None.
Okay, I don't think we really need the testimony then, unless there's... So it's just you have a site picked out. You just need to get this adjusted a little bit. All right. What? Is there anybody in the room that wants to testify against this? All right. Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that House File 3116 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And where?
I'll see you tonight.
It's here. Representative Swales, same room. So let's say 6 p.m., okay? 6? Okay. All right. Then. Yep. Mr. Stein. And Representative Bigham.
You may have John Stein sit right next to me. This is the one time, Mr. Chair, that Mr. Stein and I aren't going to be arguing about PFCs in my water in my district.
Good.
How you doing, Mr. Stein?
Doing well, Representative.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Whoever wants to proceed can proceed.
Okay. Well, members, I want to share a little story about I had the honor last year of being a Humphrey Fellow as Representative Rood, and I believe Representative Murphy has been, too. And I'm going to, I don't know if, I think there's actually been a few members in here that have, and that's, it's a program, without going into too many details, with the Humphrey Institute, and it just brings together a bunch of different professionals in a class, and we talk about policy. Well, one of the topics that my group decided to take on was HIV, because my experience here is that there really hadn't been much preventative care or preventative programming or educational programming for this cause. And so it was just a very good experience learning about the issues that we have. And then this fall, when it was released that the HIV rates had increased, has really spurred me into cause, and I just really want to say thank you to Mr. Chair here for agreeing to have a hearing about this, but also to the participants in my group at the Humphrey Fellows, and unfortunately, due to time constraints, I wasn't able to get everybody here to hear the presentation, so hopefully tonight when I'm at the dinner for the Humphrey Institute, we'll be able to tell them. But I just think that it is very important during these times when we have no money. Mr. Chair, you know that. Everybody here knows that. In fact, we're going to probably be cutting money, and we will be. And our other job as legislators, folks, is oversight. And I had a meeting with stakeholders to find out how are we using existing funds to make sure that we are targeting the needs of the community, to make sure that we are educating folks about HIV, and what are we doing to prevent the spread of HIV. So with that, Mr. Chair, unless there's technical difficulties, I can turn it over to either Mr. Carr or Mr. Stein.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Stein, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health, overseeing health protection, and I'm just here to provide support and additional response to questions that might come up. But Mr. Carr is going to make the presentation regarding our recently released information and a general update on HIV and STD data in the state. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Carr.
Welcome, Mr. Carr.
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Carr, and I'm the head of the State Health Department's STD and HIV program. And I was asked to do an update on both sexually transmitted diseases and HIV and talk a little bit about what we're doing in response to that. And there's going to be a lot of statistics and graphs coming at you. That's what I do. But to start off, maybe from my perception, there's a couple of major take-home messages. And first, relative to STDs, is that STDs, we'll get into the details here, but they are increasing over time, and they have the greatest impact on adolescents and young adults and communities of color. So that's one point. And the other point on HIV is that HIV still matters. It's not going away. We're not hearing as much about it in the news anymore, but it's still an important public health issue in Minnesota. So with that, I'll launch into the presentation here. First off, when we're talking about sexually transmitted diseases, we track chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, and they're all bacterial infections, and that means that they can be treated effectively and quite easily with antibiotics. And that in women, one of the critical points is that most of the time, women don't know they have these infections. 75% of the chlamydia infections have no symptoms, and 50% of the gonorrhea infections are the same way. That means testing is really important and screening for these infections. And then lastly, that if these infections go untreated, they can have lasting and major reproductive health consequences for women. It can lead to infertility and pelvic inflammatory disease. So here's, let's start off with some of the graphs. There are three lines on this graph. The top line represents chlamydia rates over the last 10 years or so. And the point here is that they've better than doubled over the last 10 years. And we don't think that's an artifact of more testing or better test technology. We think that there's a real increase in the population. The middle line is gonorrhea. That's remained fairly stable. And the bottom line in yellow is syphilis, and we have seen an increase in syphilis over the last 5 years. And to give you an idea about the relative numbers, these, our most recent statistics are from 2008, where we had better than 14,000 chlamydia cases reported to us, 3,000 some gonorrhea cases, and about 263 syphilis cases. So STDs, are the, in particular chlamydia, are the most common of all the reportable diseases that come into the State Health Department. Looking at chlamydia geographically, it's fairly well distributed across the state. About 70% of the infections are reported from among metro area residents and 30% among greater Minnesota residents. But just about around the entire state we'll find chlamydia. And this graph depicts the impact on adolescents and young adults and among women. The higher the bar, the higher the rates. The biggest rates are in 15 to 24-year-olds. And you'll notice that the, I guess they're sort of pink bars, are quite a bit higher. Those are the rates among women. And they're higher because women are more likely to be tested than men. So that is an artifact of healthcare-seeking behavior. And one of the defining characteristics of all these things is the disparities among communities of color. So this graph illustrates the rates of chlamydia by race. And you'll notice that the rates for African Americans are orders of magnitude higher than for whites. And moving on to gonorrhea. Gonorrhea tends to be a little more concentrated in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. 80% of the cases occur in the Twin Cities. And in fact, there's a pretty good concentration in the city of Minneapolis. And then look, this graph is the same graph as we just saw for chlamydia by age and gender. And you see the same thing. The greatest impact is among 15 to 24-year-olds. And we've got the same disparities picture. It's even more highlighted for gonorrhea. The rates are orders of magnitude higher among African Americans. And just a quick comment here on that piece. There's new evidence and strong evidence to suggest that this isn't a result of a greater amount of risky behavior. It's that there are factors called social determinants, like things like access to health care, socioeconomic status, poverty, and institutionalized racism that are really driving this forward, more so than any differences in behaviors.
Can you explain that, what you mean by that, a little more?
Sure. So just really quickly, they've done studies, and they look at the rates of new partners and condom use among African-Americans and among whites, and people that have the same level of condom use and the same level of new partners, the rates of STDs are higher among African-Americans, even though the rates of risky behaviors are the same. So there's something else at work, essentially.
So is it, I mean, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's no hidden agenda in this question for everybody in the room, okay? But you use the term institutionalized racism, and mm-hmm. In this context, I want to understand what you mean by that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah. Factors that result in things like we still have geographical, in effect, concentrations of African-American communities, so North Minneapolis and South Minneapolis, and those are, in a sense, the after effect of long-term social effects of how we manage, how we deal with race in this country. So that's the kind of thing that I was referring
so
to.
So if there's already higher rates in that community, that's going to kind of accelerate itself naturally?
Mr. Chairman, exactly. It perpetuates, you've got, and the point there, and you're, that makes a very good point, that if the rates are higher to start with, it's easier for them to keep rolling. Because the likelihood of encountering someone with one of these infections is greater in those communities.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So then there's a connection, and this is the segue to the HIV portion of the presentation, in that STD infections, if you have one of these infections, it increases, and you also have HIV, it increases your risk of transmitting HIV. So you're maybe three times more likely to transmit HIV if you've got a bacterial STD. And the same is true on the other side of the equation. If you have an STD, you're more likely to acquire HIV if you're exposed to it than if you don't. So there's a connection there. So moving on to HIV, this is a quick HIV 101, on one slide. HIV is the virus that causes AIDS. And HIV is spread sexually by sharing needles and from pregnant women to their babies. It's exchanged bodily fluids. In Minnesota, the predominant mode of transmission is sexual transmission. And that is true among gay and bisexual men as well as among heterosexuals. And the way HIV works, it's really a diabolical organism. It attacks the immune system that the body has in place to protect or protect against infectious diseases. And it wreaks havoc with the immune system that makes people vulnerable to a variety of infections and some cancers that normally your immune system would be able to handle just fine. So HIV is indeed preventable. HIV prevention works. And we know that because despite, and we'll see some graphs here in a second, every year we add 250 to 300 people living with HIV in Minnesota, largely due to the success of the treatments. So there's a bigger and bigger pool of people with HIV. The number of new infections has not kept pace. The number of new infections has remained fairly stable over time. So I think we're keeping the lid on things. And HIV prevention saves money. Every case of HIV prevented saves an estimated $355,000 in medical costs. HIV can be treated, but it's a lifetime of treatment. And lastly, HIV testing is an important element in a prevention program, in that a lot like some of the bacterial infections, people can, once they get over the acute phase of the infection, it can be 6, 8, 10 years before they get really sick and develop AIDS. So there's a long period where people are infected, can transmit, but don't necessarily know they've got it. So testing is an important part of the picture. HIV is treatable. There's no vaccine or cure yet, but it can be treated successfully. People with HIV can lead pretty much normal lives, but the medications are powerful, a lot of times have serious side effects, and they are expensive, and you're looking at a lifetime of treatment. There is no cure. You can keep the virus in check. If you stop taking your medications, the virus will reappear. So I mentioned that we've been fairly stable. We did see, however, in 2009, we saw a 18% increase overall in infections, and that was a dramatic departure from what we've seen over the last 10 years. And what was driving that increase was a really major increase in the number of infections among adolescent and young males in 2009. And that was an 83% increase, a big bump in young men. And so the logical question is, what's causing that? What's driving that change? We don't know of anything that occurred in 2009 that would explain that. There are some possibilities that if you notice, this increase has really been going on for a little while. And we don't think that increased testing accounted for the increase. We looked at the tests done by the sites that we fund for testing. Their rate of testing was about the same. So we think this is probably a real increase. And some of the factors that are probably at work here is a general lack of public awareness that HIV is still an important issue in this country and in Minnesota. People hear about it globally. Obviously, the HIV situation in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the world is a lot more dramatic than in Minnesota, but still an issue here. And that there may be a sense of complacency among young men who didn't experience the early part of the epidemic, when this infection was certainly, almost certainly, a death sentence, can be treated successfully. So there's speculation that that complacency might be an issue. And young men also haven't had the benefit of 20-plus years of education that older men have had. I mean, we've been talking about this for 20-some years now. And young men haven't had that experience. And there are other factors, like the Internet is now being used as a way to make connections, and it's a really efficient way to hook up with a partner. And that's something new as well. Looking at the geography of HIV in Minnesota, it's really focused in the Twin Cities area. And the darker the shade here, it's like those other graphs, the more infections. And in fact, 86% of the new infections are among metro area residents and 14% among greater Minnesota residents. And you'll notice that the places like that have larger cities, like Olmsted County, Rochester, and Stearns County with St. Cloud, also have slightly higher rates. And this is the graph that shows the number of people living with HIV over time. And as I mentioned, this is increasing. And this is a direct result of the success of the antiretroviral treatments that are available to treat HIV. More and more people are living with HIV every year because people are being treated successfully. And HIV, like the bacterial STDs, impact communities of color. And with HIV, we're able to make the distinction between African-American and African-born immigrants, and those are the highest rates are among those two communities. In fact, the highest rates are among African-born communities compared to white communities. And this graph illustrates one of the success stories and some of the good news in all of this. And this is the number, the top line is the number of HIV-positive moms giving birth to babies. And so that's been increasing dramatically on a regular basis since 1996. And the bottom line, which is bouncing right along at the zero mark, is the number of babies that actually get HIV from as a result of their moms being HIV positive. And this is a great example of how HIV prevention can work, that the system is working. HIV testing is a routine part of prenatal care, and we've got medicines that can treat the moms and the babies and really effectively prevent HIV from that route. So what we've been doing in response at the State Health Department, I'm going to be talking specifically about prevention. There's a whole other arena related to treatment and care. But what we do at the Health Department is we support HIV testing at six clinics provides low-cost or free HIV testing. We support HIV prevention programs in, it's actually 25 community organizations. We have a competitive grants process where we award funding to community organizations that are best suited to meet the needs of their communities for HIV prevention.
So that's culturally specific in some cases?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Those prevention programs are designed for specific communities and designed to be culturally appropriate. The Department of Human Services is involved in Minnesota with providing support for statewide services that include payment for HIV medications, health insurance premiums, medical case management, and other supportive services. And that's done on a statewide basis. In the metropolitan area, the Hennepin County Public Health Department, they use federal Ryan White funds to support HIV primary care and other core medical services, as well as case management in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. So between DHS and Hennepin County Public Health, they cover the state for care and services. And some of the things that we are thinking about at the health department, Representative Bigham made the point that we got to be maybe doing something different. To start off with, one of the points is that treatment without prevention is not sustainable. If you think back to that graph of the number of people living with HIV, it keeps going up every year. We're not going to be able to sustain the response to help take care of those people unless we slow down the pipeline. And one of the things that we're looking at doing is building capacity through partnerships with a broader range of clinics and community organizations. We're in the process of developing a Minnesota State HIV prevention strategy that will be a tool to enable and equip a broader range of partners to get involved in testing and prevention. And we think that has some real promise. And then we need to be looking at better ways to connect with the populations at risk. Using social internet sites, networking sites like Facebook, and other new communication tools to deliver our prevention messages. We got to meet people where they're at using the way, the means that they communicate. I have to think that a lot of 20-year-old men are a lot going to our website to download fact sheets. It's important to have those there, and we'll continue to do that. But I think we need to be reaching out and connecting with people using the methods that they use. And as I mentioned, the social determinants are known to be a big factor, and we need to be thinking about ways to partner with a broad range of folks to address those issues. And as I mentioned, we're in the process of developing a prevention strategy. And then lastly, and this is not something that we're directly involved in at the state level, but at the national and international level, there are a variety of biomedical interventions in the works, like continued work on a vaccine. In Africa, there's evidence that circumcision is an effective means of preventing HIV. Microbicides that women can use to prevent HIV are under development. And then there are also clinical trials underway to determine whether or not using HIV medications, antiretrovirals, that are used to treat people could be used ahead of time to prevent HIV. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Carr, I am wondering if you can talk a little bit about the rate of increase of HIV infection in the gay and bisexual population in Minnesota, and if there's a breakout of that population, and if there's a risk attached to that population that you could share with us.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yeah, a lot of the increase that we saw in that among young men was accounted for by young gay and bisexual men. So that's really part of what's driving the overall increase, and certainly the increase in young men. And again, we don't know of anything that occurred specifically in 2009 that can account for that, but some of those broader factors that probably at work helping to fuel this.
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bingham, for bringing this up. It's always interesting, sad, I guess. And I found the your comments about the increase in the younger population interesting, being in San Francisco with Representative Hayden during the 80s when the virus was being identified, and they don't have any memory of that. So it's interesting to think about how that's impacted their behavior. I'm wondering if you keep any information or gather any data about the inability for people to pay for the treatment. I know in my clinic I've seen patients again and again who we've diagnosed them with chlamydia, but they can't afford the treatment. So they come back in again, that, you know, of course they still have it, and we're hearing that they can't afford it. And so that's a concern. I'm also concerned because I know our clinic is no longer providing care in that Brooklyn Center area. So where we have high-risk populations, there's a tendency, I'm afraid, there's going to be an increasing tendency for providers to no longer be there to provide those services.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't track that. We don't have the ability to track the ability of people to pay or not. So I'm sorry. Right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bingham.
And Representative Ruta, members, the one thing I would point out, and I think during these budget times when we're talking about, and again, I know we don't have any money, but the one thing I would point out is if you would take the number of new cases times the $355,000 over a lifetime, that's a pretty big pot of money that it would be preventative medicine in a way that an example of how much it costs over a lifetime. And I think to me that was a big eye-opener about having to do something on the proactive side with education and with prevention of spreading HIV. And the other thing I'd point out for members, we do have our friends from the Minnesota AIDS Project here if there are any questions about that they folks have questions for them.
Okay. Well, okay, we got to move on. So, but thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Really Chair, for your time it. And members.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for all the work you're doing. Representative Hornstein. So we have about 17 minutes. I will move House File 2986 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on K-12 Policy. K-12 Education Policy, is that right, Frank?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
And we are going to focus, members, on the health-related aspects of this and witnesses. We're not going to get into discussions of who should have control over curriculum and any of that kind of stuff. So, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
that's for another committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And amazingly enough, you know, you and I were elected the same year, and this is my first time at the Health Policy Committee. So, as is the custom and usage in the state legislature, I have snacks for everybody. I figured it's the Health Committee, and it's Nutrition Day, so I didn't do my typical run to turtle bread for chocolate chip cookies, so I hope you enjoy the clementine.
Mr. Chairman, we're supposed to wash produce before we eat it. That's one of the health guidelines.
Well, that's an option, and it's a matter of personal responsibility. So, with that, Mr. Chair, I'm very pleased to present to you House File 2986. And many of you, the members that were here prior to 2008, have seen a version of this bill, a similar bill that Representative Walker has passed through onto the House floor, and I believe was passed on the House floor that session. Really, it's just three basic main points. We are creating here standards for medically accurate, age-appropriate sex education for public school students in grades 6 through 12. We are allowing school districts a considerable authority to determine how to fulfill the requirement and continuing our tradition of local control. And it allows parents the choice of exempting their children to participate from all or part of a sex ed program. And members, I'm just going to conclude here because I know time is of the essence by saying that I do believe, especially given what we just heard, that this is really a health, major, major health policy challenge. We have seen just in the last few months the study that was referenced today just now about STDs and AIDS. We've also seen new studies related to the increase in teen pregnancy. And so this really is a response to that health policy challenge. So I have several people who will testify just briefly, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to introduce Lori Albashir. She's the policy director of the Minnesota Organization on Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and Parenting.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Laurie Alvesher. I'm the policy director at the Minnesota Organization on Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and Parenting, and I am here today on behalf of the Coalition for Responsible Sex Ed. Our coalition is a broad coalition of education, religious, health, social service, and advocacy organizations. We have over 50 organizational members and over 800 individual members, reflecting the broad support for responsible sex ed across Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide information today to the Health Committee regarding House File 2986. Representative Hornstein gave you an overview of what is consistent in the bill and has been over the years, and I'm going to point out today the reason that one thing that is new and the reason that we are in front of you today. For the first time ever, federal funding is becoming a reality for evidence-based sex ed programs. In December of 2009, Congress passed a fiscal year 2010 budget that included $114.5 million that would be available for evidence-based programs. This will be available in the form of competitive grants, and public and private entities will be eligible for those dollars. In addition, there are $50 million included in the pending health care reform bills. We do expect that those would become available as formula grants to states when and if the health care reform bill passes. In Subdivision 5 of House File 2986, we ask that the Minnesota Department of Education and the Minnesota Department of Health request available federal dollars to support programs consistent with responsible sex education as outlined in this bill. We've asked our next two testifiers to highlight the public health outcomes that we could accomplish with this money in Minnesota. Our coalition acknowledges the interconnectedness and interconnected roles of schools, healthcare providers, faith community, parents, and other caring adults in helping young people navigate healthy decision making. We support House File 2986 because we support what works to prevent unintended pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, and HIV. We support this bill because it is a sound public health prevention policy.
Thank you. Ms. Eisenberg and Ms. Done? Yeah, thank you.
Welcome. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today about what we know regarding effective sexuality education for young people. I'm Dr. Marla Eisenberg. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics and the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. Much of my work over the past 15 years has focused on effective approaches to teen pregnancy prevention and attitudes about school-based sexuality education and promoting healthy development in children. I've published over 50 scientific articles on these issues, and I provide scientific reviews for over 20 research journals focused on child and adolescent health. I also live in Minneapolis in Representative Loeffler's district, and I have two children, a third grader and a soon-to-be kindergartner at our neighborhood public schools. So these issues touch me personally as well as professionally. I'd like to make two points today. First, medically accurate, responsible sex education in the schools is supported by the overwhelming majority of Minnesota parents, not just Minnesota adults. A couple years ago, I led a team of researchers in a statewide survey of 1,600 parents of school-aged children sampled across our 8 congressional districts, asking what parents would like to see taught in our public schools. As detailed in a 2008 scientific research paper published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Adolescent Health, Minnesota parents want children to receive encouragement to abstain from sex and also to receive accurate information about birth control, family planning, condoms, and prevention of pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. 90% of parents supported this, and this cross-cuts political orientation, religious preference, gender, age group, education level, and income level. We also found this level of support in all 8 of our congressional districts in the state. It's unusual to see this level of concurrence in a survey, and these results reflect the findings that we see from parent surveys in other areas of the country as well. Our results went even further, actually. We found that even for controversial issues such as sexual orientation and abortion, 2/3 of parents supported school-based education on these topics. These findings are detailed in the handout that you received from our Prevention Research Center at the university. Second, I believe it's very important to answer this question, the question that my colleagues and I are most frequently asked when we speak with parents, legislators, and the media. How does medically accurate sex education affect our kids? When schools use rigorously tested and evaluated curricula, what happens? This is what we know from the scientific research here in Minnesota, in the United States, and around the world. The impact of this kind of sex ed includes delays in the age of first intercourse, increased proper use of condoms and contraceptives among sexually active adolescents, fewer sexual partners over time, and lower rates of pregnancy, abortion, and birth among young people. Based on the current scientific evidence, other forms of sex education that only discuss abstinence until marriage and that include medically inaccurate information about contraception do not show these healthy changes in behavior. According to a major review commissioned by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which was undertaken to show the impact of federally funded abstinence-only programs, and I quote, "Findings indicate that youth in the abstinence-only program group were no more likely than control group youth to have abstained from sex. And among those who reported having had sex, they had similar numbers of sexual partners and had initiated sex at the same mean age," end quote. The evidence is clear and consistent. We have rigorously tested sexuality education programs that show healthy benefits to youth, and we have abstinence-only until marriage programs that do not. Thank you again for this opportunity to be with you today. I'm strongly committed to effective action based on evidence that provides our young people with the opportunities and the experiences they need to be safe, strong, and healthy. I'd be happy to answer your questions today and in the future, and my contact information is on your handout.
And Representative Gottwald, I think, had a quick question. We want to make sure we get to all the witnesses.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out there is, in fact, studies that indicate abstinence only does work at preventing disease. Those apparently aren't being issued in evidence here or in testimony, which is unfortunate, but this is a broader discussion about medical efficacy of various approaches. Also, I believe your research does not include surveying people about the type of curriculum involved, and I think that's another issue. I realize we're not supposed to speak to curriculum, but those numbers would change dramatically, I think, if parents got a chance to see what was being shared with their kids.
Mr. Chair, may I comment? Yeah. May I respond? Sure. Representative, thank you for the question. You raised two important points. The first one I would like to comment on is about a recent study that I think you may be referring to, which showed that an abstinence-only education program was indeed effective in delaying first intercourse. I'd like to assure you that my colleagues and I read this study with great interest when it came out, and I'd like to share a couple important features of this study with you as it relates to this discussion of sexuality education. First of all, the methods and design of this recent study are top rate. The researchers are very well respected, and the report is published in a top-tier research journal on adolescent health. The thing that I'd like to make particular note of, though, is that the abstinence program used in this particular study is really very different from the abstinence-only until marriage programs that have been supported by the federal government and that make up the bulk of the failed programs that we've seen. Some specific differences. The authors state, quote, "It was not designed to meet federal criteria for abstinence-only programs. The target behavior was abstaining from intercourse until a time later in life when the adolescent is more prepared to handle the consequences of sex." Secondly, the intervention did not contain any inaccurate information, it didn't portray sex in a negative light, and it didn't use a moralistic tone, which are some very common shortcomings of the abstinence until marriage programs that we've seen. And finally, the training in the curriculum manual explicitly instructed the facilitators not to disparage the efficacy of condoms or to allow the view that condoms are ineffective to go uncorrected. So these are some really important differences which might explain the success of this kind of program compared to some of the other abstinence programs that we've seen. In addition, I'd point out that the sample for this study was urban African-American students whose average age was about 12 years old. So while abstinence only might be a developmentally appropriate standard for that age group, I would submit that it is not a one-size-fits-all approach that can be applied equally as young people move through their adolescence and a majority do become sexually active. And the authors themselves state that the generalizability of those results may be limited to African American students in that age group.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Dunn. Thank you very much for coming. And it's got to be really quick. I'm sorry.
I will do that. Representative Thiessen and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Donna Dunn. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. and I am pleased to be here to provide our support to this bill. MnCASA provides education, training, and advocacy to the statewide network of sexual assault programs that are serving survivors, supporting communities, raising awareness in communities about violence that uses sex, and starting and increasing our conversation about the prevention of sexual violence. It was just 1 year ago that I had the opportunity to meet with this committee to talk about the incidence of sexual violence in Minnesota and to talk about the findings in the Minnesota Department of Health's study, The Cost of Sexual Violence. At that time, we would have talked about and did talk about the incidence of sexual violence among youth, and most national studies do indicate that 1 in 4 females and 1 in 6 to 7 males experience a sexual assault before the age of 18. So we know this is an issue that is large and looms large in the lives of our children. At the time, it was important that when I met with you, we realized that was probably the first opportunity that we have had to present the issue of sexual violence prevention as a public health issue in a committee at the state legislature, and we thank you for that. We were hoping at that time to change one reality, and that is the number of state dollars that are targeted to prevention. That didn't happen. We see the opportunity for that increasing now as even being less ripe. However, I'm here to say that the bill before this committee today is something that we can do to have an impact on the primary prevention of sexual violence, and we can do it at no cost to the state of Minnesota. As a representative of this network of programs across Minnesota, I would like to just point out that we know and we understand that schools are important partners in communities across the state to help promote awareness and knowledge about sexual violence prevention. To the extent that schools have clear guidance about how to fulfill the state's comprehensive sexual health requirement, it will not only strengthen their role as partners in our community-based work, but will also remove the barriers that sometimes have unwisely restricted or prevented our abilities to work with local schools on sexual violence prevention. I want you to know that there's a strong base of support for this work in Minnesota. In December, we convened what was called the Minnesota Summit to Prevent Sexual Violence. We had 200 people come together, half from issue experts, half were representing business communities, faith communities, industry, health organizations, the media. And one of the outcomes of that gathering was that comprehensive sexual and health education is critical to creating a base of sexual violence prevention in our state. I want to share with you just very briefly also...
We really have to stop. I'm sorry. We have to give the opponent some time here.
Okay.
I apologize for that.
All right.
If you have like 30 seconds, you want to wrap up.
I would like to just say that we know that that our young people are accessing sexuality education. As Frank Jewell, Men of Peacemakers director in Duluth, has said, with two clicks of the mouse, any one of our children can get to, quote, sexual education. That is not, we presume, the education that we want to have available to our youth. And so we are here to say that we really support healthy sexuality education that can go a long way to preventing sexual violence. Thank you for giving me these moments.
Thank you. The opponents want to come down? So it's Ms. Anderson, Ms. Chung, and Mr. Darrell. And unfortunately, they're going to get really mad at me if we go more than 5 minutes, because there's another committee that's coming in.
5 minutes total?
Yeah.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Terry Chung, and I live in Chanhassen. My husband and I have 3 children, 2 in college and 1 high school junior. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to the Responsible Family Life and Sexuality Education Bill. My purpose is to share my child's exposure to the teaching methods, the kind of information taught, and the unhealthy impression it made on the developing minds of my daughter and her friends. My daughter's 10th grade health class includes comprehensive sex education. I was never informed by the school of the materials, type of instruction, and methods that were going to be used, even after my husband and I had requested that the parents be notified of the impending instruction. The sex ed classes are taught by an outside clinic. These instructors use their own comprehensive sex education materials and instructional methods. The class combines boys and girls together, and the instructors are both male and female, and the female instructor asks the students to call her the sex lady. In one of the classes, the male
and the, you know, this committee is not the education committee,
right.
It's the health committee. So to the extent your testimony goes to the public health impact of this or whether the Department of Health should apply for these funds,
true.
I'd like you to restrict it to that.
Yes, sir. Yes. Okay, I'm giving information on to how this affected the health of my child and the kind of instruction that affected her, how she feels in her classroom. I am saying that the nickname, that they had a wooden penis and they had nicknamed it Mr. Woody, which was offensive to her. In one class, the instructor played a game where the students were blindfolded and raced each other to see how they could put a condom on the wooden penis the fastest. Another instructor had students write the steps of getting ready for sex and putting on a condom on cards and made them stand up in front of the class in order to demonstrate those steps. Following that demonstration, the instructor delivered the unhealthy message, "Now you can enjoy the thrills of sex." A friend's son commented that he and his friends were given the impression by the instructors that everyone is having sex, and that you should be having sex, and if you're in the minority not having sex, something is wrong. The instructors never talked about whether the students are psychologically ready for sex, that saving sex for marriage is healthy, or discuss any of the healthy aspects of abstinence. In fact, the instructor defined abstinence as two people in the same room with their pants on. This is a typical example of the bias and lack of respect given to abstinence, the people who practice it, and to the medical evidence that shows abstinence before marriage is the healthiest of choices. As you can see, the comprehensive sex education program at my child's school does not respect community values, encourage family communication, or contribute to healthy relationships, or emphasize abstinence, which are just some of the definitions within the legislation. I oppose this legislation as I believe it promotes unhealthy sexual behavior, undermines parental responsibility to direct their own children's sexuality training, and has an unscientific bias against real sexual health solutions for kids. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barb Anderson. I'm a former teacher and a research analyst with the Minnesota Family Council. I'm speaking in opposition to House File 2986. Responsible Family Life and Sexuality Education is just another nice sounding name for comprehensive sex education. And you've already heard about some examples of the unhealthy content that is in these kinds of curriculum materials, and I have handouts there that were passed out for you to see those examples, so I will not dwell on the content. Three points of why I oppose this. It is, number one, unhealthy. Secondly, comprehensive sex education isn't working. You can see that from the results, the high unwed pregnancy rate and the STD rate in our state. And when you look at the comprehensive sex education materials, responsible sex is a common phrase that they use in these materials, but this means nothing more than having sex with a condom. Kids are presented with three equivalent forms of intercourse: vaginal, oral, and anal. These behaviors are presented as though they carry equal risk for STDs, and they give kids the impression that condoms offer equal protection for vaginal, oral, or anal sex. This is a dangerous notion that puts the health and well-being of our kids at risk. Where is the medical evidence that says that anal sex with a condom is healthy? Thirdly, comprehensive sex education is outdated. And I want to talk about three particular areas that comprehensive sex education ignores. Number one, it ignores the hard science and recent discoveries from neuroscience research about how the teenage brain functions. The teenage brain is immature and functions differently from an adult's, and the last area to develop is the prefrontal cortex. That's the area of the brain center for reasoning, suppressing impulses, making judgments, decisions, planning. But the premise of teaching comprehensive contraceptive safe sex is based on the assumption that kids can think through these complex issues and plan ahead and use contraceptives effectively and consider the consequences, and we find out that this is not true. And adults in these classes simply see their role as providing information and skills. Neuroscience shows that this is not working. Secondly, they ignore the hard science about the teen cervix. The teenage girl's cervix is immature, and it is very vulnerable to infection due to an area that's called the transformation zone. And I want to show you a drawing here that shows on the bottom the transformation zone on the cervix of a young teenager, which is one layer of cells thick. And on the top, you can see that as a girl matures into her 20s, there are many cells, 30 to 40 layers of cells. So while a teenager is very vulnerable to STDs, when she gets in her 20s, she is not as vulnerable to them. So this science is showing that young girls should not be having sex outside of marriage.
And lastly, comp sex ed ignores the hard science about the bonding hormone oxytocin. We know that this is a hormone that is released during intercourse and that this causes bonding and a feeling of trust and attachment. Multiple sex partners leading to bonding and breakup damage a young person's ability for future ability to bond. In conclusion, comprehensive sex ed is unhealthy, it isn't working, and it is outdated. What we need is a change in philosophy and a change in our thinking. You know, there's an old country western song that says, I'm living up to your low expectations, and that is exactly what we see in comprehensive sex education. That's what our kids are doing. They need adults in positions of authority to raise the expectation for sexual behavior, and that is abstinence education, not more irresponsible, unhealthy, comprehensive sex education. Thank you.
Members are going to go into recess now because they got to get the next committee in. We'll come back at 6.
Okay. So
I'm sorry. They're coming in and they're going to get mad. So we're
2 minutes. If I condense, please.
We 1 minute is all we have.
All right, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, committee members. My name is Chuck Darrell. I'm with the Minnesota Family Council. I'm here to oppose House File 2986. To boil it down, I think Barb mentioned that a term, low expectations. I want to encourage the committee members to start thinking about the bias that exists in our approach to sex ed and sexuality. The bias basically is the free sex sexual revolution of the 1960s that says we're not going to be judgmental against anybody for having sex. Kids are going to do it anyway. There's a wink of an eye and says, almost blame them, let's be realistic. It's not working. And a lot of Minnesota parents are starting to wake up to the fact and they're starting to question whether the answer to this is more condoms, creams, pills, and vaccines. What they're looking for is a game changer. And that game changer, in coming close to the end, was introduced a little bit earlier. In what the Washington Post heralded as a landmark study, there's new evidence that says abstinence education is superior to comprehensive sex ed. The latest study by University of Pennsylvania professor released on February 1st, 2010, reports that abstinence education is working. The federally funded study published in the Archives of the Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine showed that a high-risk population of 6th and 7th graders that received abstinence-centered education reduced sexual initiation and reduced the number of sexual partners. On a particular note, students were significantly less likely to initiate sex with the abstinence-centered approach than any other education strategy, including the mixed comprehensive message that House File 2986 proposes. In other words, they got away from their bias and they started to say, look, it's our behavior that's getting us in trouble. We have to look at everything if we're going to be medically accurate. We have to look at what is it that's getting us here. It's that our kids are having sex. It's getting them sick and unhealthy. Mr. Chairman, committee, it's this free sex bias that causes our kids to get sick. And until we address this bias, the results won't change. In fact, research like this University of Penn study shows that when we move forward, unclouded by the ideology and the bias brought to this approach, it points out that healthy behavior is most likely to occur with an unambiguous message about sex. Please veto this bill.
Okay. And we are in recess. Representative Liebling had a question.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I had my question pretty much answered in the interim. So I had a question sort of about how the operational piece for pharmacists, because of the bill, for instance, requires them to determine that the person who's consenting has authority. I mean, you know, it says it could be a spouse or so on, but I just wondered if that meant that they had to, make the determination if that person was authorized to consent and how that would work. But what we're going to do is we'll deal with that in the Finance Committee. Just they'll get some information, the author will get some information for me in the meantime, and, you know, we'll deal with that down the road.
Does anybody else wants to testify on this bill? Okay. All right. Then, did you want to say anything else, Representative Swills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I really feel like we had a good discussion earlier. I think a lot of things were made clear. I've heard from a couple of members that they learned a lot from the discussion, and I think that's what is hoped for by this bill, as well as being able to give medications that are appropriate to our patients who have epilepsy. So I really, truly thank this committee for your consideration.
Okay. Then, seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 1320 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails, and we are adjourned.